Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Kevin Bankston of the Electronic Frontier Foundation, who assesses efforts in Congress to roll back some provisions of the USA Patriot Act that are seen by many as standing in violation of basic constitutional rights. Chris Housen of the March of Dimes Foundation, who talks about a report on premature births, which found that 13 million babies around the world are born prematurely every year, with 1 million of that number dying. And Dr. Andy Coates, Assistant Professor of Medicine and Psychiatry at Albany Medical College, who discusses what he sees as the deficiencies in the current congressional debate on national health care reform. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The Washington Post reports the government of Sudan sought to influence American public opinion through contacts with Reagan-era National Security Advisor Robert Bud McFarlane, a figure in the Iran-Contra scandal and last fall an advisor to John McCain's presidential campaign. Sudanese officials used a back channel to deal with McFarlane, who has a $1.3 million contract with the Gulf state of Qatar to work on peacemaking initiatives in East Africa. In recent months, McFarlane has met with top Obama administration officials, including National Security Advisor James Jones and Sudan envoy John Scott Gratian. The administration is currently split on how to engage with Sudan, whose president, Omar Hassan al-Bashir, faces war crimes charges from the International Criminal Court. Neither McFarlane nor his firm, McFarlane Associates, have registered as lobbyists or as a foreign agent for Qatar or Sudan. McFarlane told the Washington Post he has had contacts with Sudan officials, including an intelligence operative, but has no formal ties with the government in Khartoum. Darfur activist John Prendergast, a founder of the Anti-Genocide Enough Project, says McFarlane's influence helped disrupt peace talks in Ethiopia last summer. A tribal leader backed by McFarlane asked for $6 million from U.S. envoy Scott Gratian, a move that nearly derailed the summit. Tucson, Arizona, immigrant rights activist Walt Stanton faced a sentence of a year in jail for littering in the Buenos Aires National Wildlife Refuge, which skirts the border with Mexico. After a jury trial, Stanton, a part-time web designer, was sentenced to a year probation and 300 hours of community service, picking up trash on public lands. The activist was also banned for a year from entering the National Wildlife Refuge. Ironically, Stanton was picking up trash left by Mexican migrants when Stanton and three other immigration activists were arrested in the refuge. They are all members of the activist group No More Deaths, No Más Muertes. The group leaves jugs of water in the refuge for Mexican migrants crossing through the harsh Sonoran Desert. According to the news magazine In These Times, 50,000 Mexican migrants cross the wildlife refuge each year, down from 250,000 a year before the U.S. government built a 7-mile-long, 12-foot-high wall on the Mexican border. Before his sentencing in mid-August, Stanton told In These Times, government border agents had overreacted. The activists observed, if you want to talk about disrupting wildlife, this is a war zone. They've got helicopters, ATVs, trucks all over the refuge, and they built a wall straight through the wildlife refuge. Georgia Senator Saxby Chambliss has dipped into his leadership political action committee to finance lavish golf outings at resorts in Pebble Beach, California, and Boca Raton, Florida. According to the investigative website ProPublica, Chambliss spent over $250,000 at elite golf resorts in 2007 and 2008, paid through PAC, the Republican Majority Fund. This amount exceeds $250,000 that Chambliss sent to Republican candidates. Chambliss's PAC's top contributors are defense lobbyists, the senator's friend James Irvin, and military contractors like Lockheed Martin and General Dynamics. Leadership PACs follow fewer rules and get less media scrutiny than formal campaign committees. Over the last three congressional elections, lobbyists have given $355 million to the leadership PACs, now used by 70% of members of Congress to raise money. During the 2008 campaign cycle, less than half of the $112 million raised went to support political candidates. The majority of funds went to entertainment, administrative overhead, and fundraising costs. In March, the FEC sent Congress a series of recommendations, including banning the use of leadership PACs for personal expenses. These PACs have recently been implicated in payoffs and sex scandals involving former North Carolina Senator John Edwards and Nevada Senator John Ensign. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Emily Santos-Poplowski.
In the aftermath of the September 11, 2001 terrorist attacks in New York City and Washington, D.C., President Bush succeeded in pushing Congress to pass the USA Patriot Act, a far-reaching bill that many legislators never read before voting for its passage. The act, signed into law on October 26, 2001, gave sweeping new powers to both domestic law enforcement and international intelligence agencies, while eliminating checks and balances that previously gave courts the opportunity to ensure that such powers were not abused. At the end of 2009, three provisions of the Patriot Act will expire. Many civil liberties advocates are now urging Congress to review the nation's surveillance laws and amend those that have been found unconstitutional or have been abused by law enforcement agencies to collect information on innocent people. Among the Patriot Act provisions that will sunset on December 31st are national security letters, which compel internet companies, libraries, banks, and other institutions and businesses to turn over sensitive information on their customers. The material support statute, which criminalizes providing material support to terrorists, regardless of whether they actually or intentionally further terrorist goals. And 2008 amendments to the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, or FISA, that authorizes the government to conduct warrantless, dragnet collection of U.S. residents' international phone calls and emails. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Kevin Bankston, senior staff attorney with the Electronic Frontier Foundation, which has filed lawsuits against the telecommunication companies participating in warrantless surveillance. He assesses efforts in Congress to roll back some provisions of the USA Patriot Act that are seen by many as standing in violation of basic constitutional rights.
Well, despite the vaunted supermajority in Congress and despite taking the White House last year, the Democrats are yet again negotiating against themselves rather than succeeding in presenting a unified front for surveillance reform, just as they're having difficulty rallying around a single health care proposal. As I'm sure your listeners know, the Patriot Act was a very broad surveillance, amongst other things, surveillance bill that passed immediately after 9/11 and significantly expanded the government's authority to conduct a variety of types of surveillance, not only in foreign intelligence investigations dealing with terrorists and spies, but also in garden variety criminal investigations. For example, one of the Patriot authorities for sneak and peek searches, where they execute a search warrant secretly and only notify you about it later, as Senator Feingold has noted recently, in the vast majority of cases, that power has been used to investigate drug crimes and not terrorism crimes, despite being sold as an anti-terror power. Meanwhile, last year, Congress also passed something called the FISA Amendments Act, amending the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, which deals with wiretapping and other foreign intelligence surveillance, something that Patriot also amended a few times. I'd like to say that Patriot, in a lot of ways, presented nips and tucks to the law. Although taken together, all of its powers are very worrisome, it didn't upend the fundamental structure of the law. While I call the FISA Amendments Act, or the FAA, a radical facelift of surveillance law that incredibly expanded the government's ability to warrantlessly wiretap American citizens. So as three particular Patriot provisions have come up, are set to expire at the end of this year, many have seen that debate over reauthorization as an opportunity to broadly reform Patriot, not just the expiring provisions, and in particular to reform something called the National Security Letter Authority. This is the power of the FBI to essentially just write a letter and demand private internet, phone, and credit records without any court oversight, and without those records having a demonstrated link to any terrorist or spy. Others have also felt, including us at EFF, that this is a good opportunity to address the FISA Amendments Act from last year, because in many ways, addressing Patriot reform alone is, from a civil liberties perspective, like rearranging deck chairs on the Titanic, because the FAA was so so powerful compared to what Patriot did. So Senator Feingold, apparently on the same page as we are, introduced a great bill several weeks ago called the Justice Act, co-sponsored by Senator Durbin and eight other senators. And we were hoping that that was the bill that was going to be the base bill that the Senate Judiciary Committee would consider when considering a bill to send to the floor of the Senate to reauthorize these expiring Patriot provisions. Unfortunately, the week after that, Senator Leahy, who chairs that Judiciary Committee, came out with his own bill. And it was a disappointing step back, a watering down of the Feingold bill. It contained some important reforms, but it didn't address the FISA Amendments Act at all, unlike the Feingold bill, which not only would provide new protections against Americans against warrantless wiretapping, but would also have repealed immunity for the telecoms like AT&T who were suing for helping in the United States warrantless wiretapping program. So the Leahy bill didn't contain any FISA Amendments Act reforms. It contained much fewer Patriot reforms.
Kevin Bankston, after the September 11th attacks, it seemed that a lot of American citizens were very willing to let go of their civil liberties and constitutional protections in favor of security. And I wonder, you know, 8 years after the attack, do you feel that the public is aware following these developments with regard to the government's ability to spy on citizens and revisiting the Patriot Act and replacing some of the protections lost?
I would hope so. I've been very disappointed, though, in a general lack of coverage of this issue in the mainstream media in the past few weeks. I'm particularly disappointed that when it comes to the FISA Amendments Act that passed last year, there have already been reports of abuses of that law implicating the privacy of millions of ordinary Americans. Right now, the NSA is sucking up millions of Americans' email, private email communications, and yet our Congress seems wary of even addressing minor reforms to the Patriot Act. I think it's an incredibly worrisome state of affairs, and I think that it's important that those who do care about privacy make their voice heard now, because if we don't get a good bill out of this Judiciary Committee process, we're going to be in big trouble when it comes to civil liberties and privacy protections being injected into the Patriot Act, much less the FISA Amendments Act.
That was Kevin Bankston, Senior Staff Attorney with the Electronic Frontier Foundation. Contact the foundation by calling area code 415-436-9333 or visit their website at EFF.org. The first global study of preterm births has just been completed. A collaboration between the March of Dimes Foundation and the United Nations World Health Organization found that 13 million babies are born prematurely every year and 1 million of them die. Those who survive often face a lifetime of disabilities, including hearing loss, blindness, cerebral palsy, and learning disabilities. Surprisingly, the rate, though not the total numbers, of preterm births by continent is almost as high in North America, including Canada and the United States, as it is in Africa. The UN plans to follow up this report with more detailed country-by-country research. According to the March of Dimes, the rate of premature births in the United States has increased 36% in the past 25 years. The increase in the rate of late preterm births between 34 and 36 weeks gestation accounts for most of the increase. The group points out that the emotional cost for families can be devastating and life-changing, and the financial costs affect society as a whole. Prematurity accounts for almost half of hospital charges for infants. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Chris Howson, Vice President for Global Programs at the March of Dimes Foundation, just before he delivered a report on the study at an international conference on the prevention of birth defects and disabilities in Delhi, India. He discusses what the report revealed, what's still not understood about the problem, and possible remedies.
We put out this report because we wanted to light a fire under policymakers, because we feel the issue of preterm birth internationally is one that is under-recognized, undercounted, undervalued, and underfunded.
Even though 85% of these 13 million preterm babies are born in Africa and Asia, if you look at the rates of preterm births, North America is a close second to Africa. How do you explain that?
With respect to Africa, we don't know for sure, but contributing factors include many of those associated clearly with poverty and weak health care systems. For example, the poor overall health and nutritional status of women, a high burden of infectious diseases, lack of provision of family planning, allowing a woman to decide when to start and end having children and how to space her children, and the lack of good prenatal care programs that might identify problems early on in a pregnancy. Those are clearly contributing factors in Africa. Certainly in the U.S., the three factors that seem to be prominently associated with the 36% increase is the number of women aged 35 and older who are choosing to have babies, the increase in the use of assisted reproductive techniques that can result in the implantation of multiple embryos, you know, the Octomom being an extreme example of that. And data show clearly that moms who are carrying multiples have six times the risk of having those children preterm as a mother carrying a single child. And the third factor appears to be the rise in the numbers of late preterm births, and these are babies born between 34 and 36 weeks.
You mean an increase in late preterm from what used to be full-term births?
Correct.
Chris Housen, your report lists mother's weight as a factor. Are women who are either underweight or overweight more likely to have preterm babies?
Well, you know, to be honest, we don't know what causes preterm birth. We don't know how to prevent it, and we really still don't even know how to delay a preterm birth. But there are a number of factors associated with preterm birth that, if implemented right now, and that's why we put out this report, it could go a long way toward reducing mortality and disability from preterm birth. And again, these interventions differ according to the regions that you apply them to. So, for example, in wealthy countries with strong health care systems, the recommendations are that women of childbearing age should be encouraged to see a doctor regularly, particularly if they're planning to get pregnant. And they should adopt a healthy lifestyle, including if they smoke, quitting smoking, if they were overweight, losing weight. It's not that being overweight necessarily causes preterm birth, but it is a factor associated with it.
What do you think can be done right away to reduce this toll, and what kind of costs are we talking about?
A lot could be done at a very low cost, and this is why it makes this issue so particularly poignant and, I think, serious. For example, in developing countries like Africa or Asia with weak healthcare systems, there are a number of simple low-cost interventions that can help promote a healthy pregnancy outcome. We should be treating malnutrition in women both before and during pregnancy. We should be treating infections at increased risk. We should be monitoring pregnancies carefully for signs of trouble. And should that baby be born preterm, we should care for that baby by providing a package of interventions that are also in themselves low cost, of proven efficacy. And these might include things like, if that newborn is struggling to breathe, providing assisted breathing, keeping the baby warm, for example. In many parts of Africa, newborn babies are strapped to a woman's back. Mothers can be taught to strap that baby skin to their chest, the so-called kangaroo care, and carry the baby around that way, and that keeps the baby warm and also encourages breastfeeding, which is another thing, providing adequate nutrition. And then simple things like treating infections, you know, providing antibiotics. This is a whole package of interventions that is really very, very low cost and could go a long way to saving newborn lives and diminishing the disability associated with preterm birth.
That was Chris Housen, Vice President for Global Programs at the March of Dimes Foundation. Contact the foundation by calling area code 914-997-4488. Read the preterm birth report online at marchofdimes.com. The president, Congressional Democrats and those pushing for health care reform have been on the defensive for much of the last few months, fighting malicious rumors about death panels, free medical care for illegal immigrants, and rationing. So it was refreshing when Florida Democratic Representative Alan Grayson stated on the floor of the House of Representatives that the Republican health care plan was simple: don't get sick, and if you do get sick, die quickly. The media attention he received in the days after his September 29th speech was valuable in that he was able to highlight a Harvard University study published in the American Journal of Public Health, which found that nearly 45,000 people die each year in the U.S. attributable to their lack of health insurance. As President Obama continued his campaign for congressional passage of national health care reform legislation on October 5th, he invited a group of 150 doctors, representing all 50 states, to hear him speak at the White House Rose Garden. Many of the physicians attending the event had supported Obama's candidacy and his current effort to overhaul the nation's flawed health care system. But doctors advocating for a single-payer system, like those established in most industrialized countries around the world, weren't invited to the gathering. But at the last minute, one Oregon physician, Dr. Paul Hochfeld, a member of the single-payer advocacy group Physicians for a National Health Program, or PNHP, was admitted to the event. Between the lines, Scott Harris spoke with Dr. Andy Coates, assistant professor of medicine and psychiatry at Albany Medical College and secretary of the Capital District chapter of PNHP. He reviews the importance of the Harvard University study and discusses what he sees as the deficiencies in the current congressional debate on national health care reform.
Simply because of lack of health insurance, which causes people to avoid important primary care visits, causes people to avoid going when they're sick, and causes all kinds of disruptions when it comes to follow-up when you have an acute or chronic illness. Simply by not having health insurance, one American dies every 12 minutes because they did not have health insurance. So it indicts our system severely. This is not a problem in any other industrial country.
What are your thoughts on Representative Grayson's comments?
Well, I must say that the discussion in Washington has not helped educate us, the American people, about the real issues of health reform very well. It's true that the Republican proposals that we've heard for health reform are not impressive. But, on the other hand, the insurance proposal that the Democrats have to help people buy health insurance, that if you don't buy health insurance under H.R. 3200, which, you know, hasn't been enacted, but the proposal would be, if you don't buy health insurance, you are a criminal, and you will be taxed. You will be fined. You must buy health insurance. And if you're poor, then the government would subsidize the private health insurance premiums. So the taxpayers would then pay the private health insurance company money directly to make sure that they had a profit margin. That's the essence of the proposal. That's exactly what's been done in the state of Massachusetts. And it has not worked. It has not covered everyone, and it has not reined in costs. And the costs in Massachusetts are burgeoning. There's a major budget crisis. And to make up the deficits of the budget crisis, what they've done is they've cut the safety net health care, because they have to make a cut somewhere to continue to pay the insurance company the subsidies for the premiums. And so when the safety net is cut, the very patients who most need the care don't have a place to go. And in Massachusetts, although the number of uninsured has dropped, the amount of uncompensated care, emergency room care, has not dropped by anything like the same amount. And when people are asked, did it help you or hurt you, half of the people say it hurt me. And the people who are directly affected do not support the reform. So it doesn't seem to be working by many, many measures. And that's the essence of the Democrats' proposal, is that there would be private health insurance mandatory for individuals to have it. If your employer offers it, you should get it through your employer, period. And then there would be an exchange which would broker private health insurance policies. This is very, very much the Massachusetts proposal. We've looked at it closely, and it doesn't work. So I would say that the debate in Washington, although there's some beautiful rhetoric on all sides and some truth from each side, I don't think it really educates us about what we need to do to provide comprehensive health care for everyone.
Dr. Coates, when you look at the debate on Capitol Hill over health care reform, it seems that one of the central issues of controversy is whether or not to include a public government-run health insurance option in any final piece of legislation. Do you think that's where really this debate should be focused at the moment? And if not, why not?
The idea of the public plan is something that's very, very limited. If your employer offers health insurance, you wouldn't be eligible for the public plan and so on. If you read the bills and if you read the Congressional Budget Office idea of what the so-called public option would do, it might cover 10 million people. That's hardly half the nation. But even more theoretically, the insurance market, the way it works is the winning company, if you will, the most successful, most competitive company, will avoid the sick and the poor patients, keep the healthy and wealthy patients. You know, this is how Medicare Advantage works. If you look at the data, patients who enroll in Medicare Advantage plans, private insurance coverage, although they have Medicare benefits, and then grow sick, end up out of those plans, because if you have a severe illness, you won't be able to make the premiums. There may be benefits that you can't get through your private insurer. And so the healthy go in and the sick go out when it comes to Medicare Advantage. And so I would wonder if a public plan might end up just the same, where the healthy go in and the sick go out when it comes to private insurance, but the public plan would end up where all the sick and the poor patients were, and then it would be very, very expensive. And I would just point out that if you read the bills that the Senate Health Committee passed and the bills that the three committees of the House passed, there's absolutely no public subsidy for the public option. It's meant to stand alone and compete as a company, if it does even come into being. And even then, it looks like it might be administered by private insurance companies, yet be called public. Never mind those problems. Even theoretically, if the public plan were to compete on a market that's based on this idea of keeping the healthy and the wealthy and jettisoning the sick and the poor, I don't see how that could lead to meaningful health care reform. I'd be much more afraid that that would lead to an official two-tiered system where there were public hospitals and private hospitals and public clinics and private clinics and so on.
That was Dr. Andy Coats, Assistant Professor of Medicine and Psychiatry at Albany Medical College and Secretary of the Capital District Chapter of Physicians for National Health Program. Contact the group by calling area code 312-782-6006 or visit their website at pnhp.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris, with the assistance of Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Emily Santos-Koplowski, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Vanzari.